All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuckstables, what the fucking ears, what the fuck sticks, what the fucking delics, what the fuck Minster Fullers? How about the UK? What's going on, UK? I need one for the UK. The second season of Marin and IFC starts tonight in the United Kingdom on Fox. So if you're there, that's just off the top of my head. Welcome to the show. I'm Mark Marin. I feel like I don't reach out enough to my international listeners. I know that Marin season one is going to be in Australia soon. I'll try to get dates on that. I'll try to get in the loop on that. But it is on season two starts on Fox in the UK tonight. I just want to give you a heads up because I want you to feel like I'm leaving you out. I know that we get isolated over here here in the States. There's a certain entitlement that you may think that we have, or we think we're special or whatever, but I don't always know what the hell is going on. And this morning is Thursday. My heart goes out to those victims of the idea of Ebola who are suffering today with imagined symptoms. I hope you guys are okay. And obviously to the real victims, I truly feel bad. But let's talk about other things. I mean, that's heavy, man. It's a heavy start. You know, these prehistoric bugs have had a vengeance for billions of years, and we've been lucky lately on the prehistoric bug front. Renegade strands of RNA looking to finish their job. So hopefully that'll get under control somehow. God damn it. Welcome is what I meant to say. Good morning, if it's morning for you. Today on the show, the infamous, almost mythic Bob Rubin. If you don't know Bob Rubin, he was a San Francisco comic who dominated that scene, dominated it. By the time I moved to San Francisco in the late 80s, or what was it, the early 90s, Bob had moved on. He was an occasional guest, but San Francisco comedy was all about Bob Rubin, the Rube, for a long time. Powerful character. And many of you may not know who he is, and we'll talk about that. We're going to talk to the Rube. It's an interesting decision to make to become a broad character when you're doing comedy, to be a bigger-than-life presence with a peculiar disposition and outlook and vision. When you begin to have to wrestle with that character to maybe find what's left of yourself, it's an interesting undertaking. Not many people do the full-on character. And you know what? It's never a full-on character, which I think we'll find with Rube in this conversation. So obviously, there's always part of you in it, and sometimes it gets hard to tell the difference between the two. The Rube, Bob Rubin, coming up shortly. I'm talking in radio voice today. What's going on with me? Let me give you a cat update, all right? Let's just get raw about it, all right? Because I know a lot of you people are in the loop with me on this, with the monkey situation, with the dick licking and pain and my fear and my projections about what's going on, and then my exacerbating the problem with my fear. So what I've chosen to do with this cat, he doesn't seem to be licking his dick anymore. He seems to have leveled off. He seems a little more fragile than he used to be, but that might just be age. He seems relatively healthy, other than there's something wrong with his eye, and now there seems to be something wrong with the other eye. I'm just going to wait it out. I'm actually going to take the advice of some vets that emailed me and some people out there. I'm only going to feed the cat wet food. I'm actually adding a bit of water to the wet food. It's high-end wet food. I'm hoping that, you know, it'll keep him overly hydrated and move things through his bladder, since it is sort of an undiagnosed, sort of vague inflammation of the bladder with no crystals that we know of present. And I'm just going to love the cat the best I can. I can't forget that he was always a skittish cat. He was always fucking freaked out. See, like, if I'm thinking he's freaking out more or he's freaking out less, and that's a problem, and I'm freaking out because of that, it just becomes this big sort of vortex of fucking anxiety. Meanwhile, LaFonda is like, what's up? I'm just sitting around getting fat. That's okay with you. So that's an update on the cat situation. And I do want to report that Deaf Black Cat back in the fold this morning. As of this morning, after a month-long absence, Deaf Black Cat decided, hey, maybe I'll go eat at that other place. Scaredy Cat is back around, looking healthy. That cat I haven't seen in 3 months. Back. eating the food, and I'm going to give them some fucking wet food because I want those guys around. I'll be the crack dealer in the neighborhood. I got no beef with that. Here you go. Have a nice bowl of wet food. I'll see you in a few hours, stray cat, crazy guy. So that's what's going on over here. Oh, I should tell you about a couple of exciting encounters in New York City. So, all right. I do this show for the New Yorker. It was nice to be asked to do it. It was a good show. Me and Al Madrigal and Todd Barry and Patton and Susie Essman and Baron Vaughn was there and Morgan Murphy and all right, whatever. It was a good show. Great show. And then there's the New Yorker party. All right, so here's what happens. A couple of fairly interesting events happen. I'm at the New Yorker party. It's a clusterfuck. But, you know, it's like it's that sort of like that weird New York intelligentsia. I mean, the New Yorker is still, you know, a barometer or a precedent or a whatever you want to call it. It's like the intellectual Alamo. They're holding out. They're the ones waving the banner of intellectualism in the world. And it's not an easy task because I subscribed to the New Yorker briefly. It just became too much pressure. But nonetheless, I'm at this party, and there's a lot of young people, and I'm there. You know, Nick Kroll was there. I saw Ren Azizi there, and I'm hanging out with Todd and Morgan. And then I'm like, oh, my God, there's Gay Talese. You know, like these people that I remember from when I was a kid looking at the magazine. You know, he's a writer. And then, like, I see, you know, I'm up on the roof. I'm looking over Manhattan. And then I see an older dude come in, kind of stocky guy. He comes out and sits down. I'm looking at him and I'm like, holy fuck, that's Randy Newman. That's fucking Randy Newman. Now, I don't know what your context for Randy Newman is, whether you think he's just a guy that writes cute songs for movies, which would be a tremendous disrespect to the genius that is Randy Newman. Like his first five or six albums are fucking satirical masterpieces in some respects and musically beautiful. An amazing songbook, the Randy Newman early stuff. And so I see him and this doesn't happen to me very often, but I start like stumbling. I'm like, I gotta say something, you know? So I kind of barge over there, you know, in almost a panic. And he's sitting there, there's a woman standing next to him. And I'm like, Randy Newman, I'm Mark Maron. I'm a big fan. He's like, well, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm like, I have a podcast. And I don't think I'm talking in this tone, but this is the tone that's happening inside of me. I'm like, I have a podcast. I would like to talk to you on the podcast. And he's like, well, you're going to have to call my, you know what? And I'm like, oh my God, I'm a big fan. And I'm just sitting there melting and, you know, just kind of like imploding somehow. And the woman standing next to him says, I like your podcast. I'm like, oh my God. And literally she is right next to him. And I say, is there any way you could get Randy Newman on the show? And he's standing right there. So it was not a good showing for me, really. But it turned out it was his manager. So I'm going to reach out to her. I'd love to talk to Randy Newman. So that was pretty exciting for me, even though I made a complete fucking, you know, ass out of myself. So then, you know, I decide to leave, you know, and I'm leaving the event, and I'm in an elevator, and the elevator doors open up, and like a guy walks on and he's got a hat and he's with another person. There's two other people and he turns around and it's Sting. I'm going into an elevator with Sting and he's just exuding Stingness. I think that's most of what he does is that you cannot help but feel. And when you see Sting, you are enveloped in a cloud of Stingness. You're in it. You can feel his gaze and he looks at me right in the eye and I knew the look because I don't care really. You know, I'm not going to get all excited about Sting, but your eyes do a thing when you acknowledge that you see somebody that that is, you know, Sting. And I read in his eyes that like he lives for that. He lives for that moment where people go like, oh, shit, that's Sting. Oh, there's Sting. I can feel it. I know it. I mean, he saw my look and he's like, and I looked at him and all I felt from his look was like, yeah, I am him. I'm fucking Sting. Who are you? Not registering. That's for sure. You're not Sting. So I turned my back on Sting and I overheard a conversation. It was very interesting. you know, and I kind of ice Sting because I, you know, in my mind, I wanted him to feel stung. So I turned my back on Sting and I overheard him talking to what must have been a publicist or something. And I don't like to do this. I'm not throwing anybody under the bus, but apparently he's got some sort of new show and he's having this conversation about this guy about, you know, where they should promote the show and how they should promote the show to sell tickets. And I'm thinking like, really? Sting? And then I actually heard him say it's like the challenge is to succeed against the odds. And I'm thinking like, you're fucking Sting. Didn't you win? Don't you have like $1 billion and the ability to fuck for 12 hours straight? I mean, I guess people just feel like they have to keep plugging along, which is great. I haven't been keeping up with Sting, but apparently there's a tremendous market of international fans and middle-aged women that enjoy what he does still. So anyways, I guess the point is I did not ask Sting to be on the podcast, but I did ask Randy Newman because that's who I am. So strap yourself in here. We're going to talk to the Rube. It was a pleasure to talk to Bob Rubin. I had not seen Bob Rubin in many years, and I'm glad Bob Rubin is doing well, but it's a hell of a story. So listen up. You all right with those? I don't know why people have a problem with the headphones.
My head's gigantic, man.
I've seen people...
I ran into a chapeau shop with a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And that's the only way I would have ever been seen in a chapeau shop.
I don't even know what a chapeau shop is.
You know, a hat shop.
Oh, a hat shop.
A hat shop.
Yes, sir.
My friend's like, we're riding around in his Porsche.
Yeah.
With the top down.
Right.
We could have just left it at that, mm-hmm. Riding around Hollywood with the top down. With my giant head already, I look like an Art Deco logo.
Yeah. You
know, with my arms hanging out both yeah. sides.
Mm-hmm.
He's a little fella.
Mm-hmm.
You want to know who it was?
Who?
Rob Schneider.
Sure.
He's a little fella in that Porsche. He goes, I got to buy a hat. I said, you don't have to buy a hat. You've got a nice house. You
yeah.
got a Porsche. A couple movies doing well. You don't have to buy a hat.
Yeah.
Now give me the keys to this car and let's go for it. And we ran in and these two guys came running right at me. Oh, we got to measure your head.
Yeah. Measure the head.
They were freaked out by
it. Like,
I went a little bit over eight.
A little over eight. That is big fucking head, man.
Yeah, I know.
So I'm trying to think, like, I feel like I just missed you when I got to San Francisco. Is that possible? Or maybe you were off the grid, perhaps? What were you, like, 92, 93?
Are we recording?
Sure.
You're tricky.
Yeah, it's not that tricky.
No, I know. But I thought you'd give me a 3, 2...
Okay, hold on.
No, I don't need that.
You want me to do that?
Oh, it'd be fun, though. I haven't had a real job in so long, I wouldn't mind it.
You want me to do the real radio interview? The radio setup? Like,
no.
Hey, folks, welcome. It's Bob Rubin. Hey, Bob Rubin.
Nah.
Bob, the old Rube is here. There you go.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
I'm a little rusty, man. I swear to God, nobody's asked me a question since 2008.
Do you know any of the answers?
That's not. No, I didn't.
What do
that's
you
not good, man.
No. What? Why don't? Why
nobody asked me a question. I'm not kidding you.
Really?
They haven't asked me a question since 2008. I was subpoenaed by the FBI, but that doesn't count because that's a command.
What were they subpoenaing you for?
We command you to be at federal court in Oakland on March. This happened last month.
Really?
Yeah.
For what?
Well, the funny thing is, I'm not allowed to discuss it. The second thing is, I don't even know. So why would I discuss something I don't know? I will tell you this.
Sounds like you're in a little trouble to me, Bob.
I hope not, but I will tell you this.
Yeah.
Hang on one second. I'm going to tell the audience right now I'm doing something that's a little bit technical.
Okay.
I'm adjusting the mic.
That was perfect. That
hey,
beautifully
Mark.
Done. From where I'm sitting, beautifully done.
You're a professional.
I am, sometimes.
You're the best at this podcasting.
Well, thank you very much.
No, you are.
Thank you.
I'm going to tell you later another reason why I brought that up.
Okay.
But I'll tell you later. I don't want to bounce all around the place, think like I'm yagged out on coffee or something.
Well, here's what we're going to do.
Okay.
I think what we should do is...
Okay.
Now, back when I moved to San Francisco in 1992, You know, I was running from my own thing. You know, I was chasing the dream. So I get to San Francisco, and then, you know, everyone's sort of like, have you seen Ruben? Have you seen? And by that time, you had drifted away somehow. It was like the I'd gotten there right in, like, the heyday was over, and they were wondering what was going to happen. And they were like, well, maybe it's all going to turn around. And Bob Ruben was this mythic idea. It was an idea. Bob Ruben was one of the original San Francisco guys from the original crew from the old days, like early late 80s, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And it was like, and then, like, the first time I saw you, it was like, what the fuck is this? Who the hell is this guy? What is he doing? No one does what he's doing.
Why is he doing it?
Well, yeah, well, that's a question you've got to answer for yourself.
All right. I will.
Okay. Where'd you grow up, though?
Why is he doing that? I grew up in West Virginia, Wheeling, West Virginia, you know, and I had the hillbilly thing in me.
What does that mean?
That's the hillbilly thing. I had that in me the whole time.
You grew up with that?
Yeah.
Did you grow up in a rural situation?
Everything was pretty much rural. Well, they used to have the canaries that go down in the mines.
Sure.
And if the canaries pass out, then you don't go in the mine
because
there's not enough. Yeah, there's not enough oxygen.
Oh, is that what it is? Not a gas thing? It's an oxygen thing?
Well, it's actually a gas thing, so it makes it not enough good mixture.
So you come from coal miners?
No, I came from the people that raised those little birds.
Come on.
I'm serious. You would check in. And then when I was like, between the ages of 3 and 5, I had to go in a little cage and find out if there was a good mix of oxygen and CO and carbon.
That was your job that your family gave you.
Yeah, a couple times I didn't come out, but they resuscitated me. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to go into this.
That's what made you funny.
Well, you know, my parents said that they did that because they wanted to get me out of
Virginia. What's the real story, though? What did your family
that
do?
That is the real story. Because it's like
they raised birds.
Yeah, the minor birds, what they were called.
They did. Are you fucking with me?
No, I'm not.
Your dad was in the canary business.
Well, you say it like it's something shameful.
No, it's not.
He was in the canary business.
Okay,
yeah,
man.
At big money.
Okay.
Big money. My grandpa, he was in a saloon business, but somebody broke in, shot him in the head before I was even born.
Is that true?
That's true, yeah.
What for? Do you know?
A robbery.
Oh, it was just a robbery?
Yeah.
But do you come from actual hill people?
Yes. Yeah, but, you know, the cousin's table was always weird at the get-togethers, you know, for Thanksgiving, you know, and you'd have to sit at the cousin tables, and there were like two of us.
Yeah.
And we looked exactly the same.
Stop it. Come on. Is that true?
Yes, this is true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, a lot of inbreeding. But, you know, it started in Poland.
Yeah.
I can't blame West Virginia. A lot of the inbreeding started in the old country.
Your family comes from Poland?
Poland and Russia, yeah.
Jew?
Yeah.
You're a Jew that grew up in West Virginia, and you were brought up by a canary salesman.
Yeah. And that's why, you know, I had stories to tell.
Yeah.
I said, head west, young man, you got a tale to tell now.
Well,
I broke the hillbilly barrier in San Francisco.
But is there a Jewish hillbilly? There seems to be more to the story.
Well, I'll tell you, can I tell you, I'm not going to go into jokes here.
I don't want you to go into jokes.
No, but can I tell you the one old joke from day one?
Yeah.
Since you just almost said it yourself.
Go ahead.
And I would say, yeah, if people had a hard time believing it, I go, no, I'm Jewish and I'm from West Virginia.
Yeah.
That's kind of odd. Jewish hillbilly. It means I wasn't really circumcised. A rabbi just sort of whittled on me a little bit.
Boom.
That's the old...
was that one of the first ones?
Well, I actually told that joke at a seminar held by city council, and I think that's the one where the hillbilly barrier was finally broken in San Francisco. Because before that, you had tragically hip, and you had hippies, and then you had, you know, people that came from Wisconsin to be comedians, or you had people coming from New York, Chicago, L.A., and I tell you the other thing, I remember when I was going to school in Arizona, University of Arizona, and I was working on the school concert board, and I went to pick up Marcia Wallace.
Yeah.
And I picked her brain. I was picking her up at the airport, taking her to a concert.
Yeah.
And she was opening up for the Busboys.
Right.
Minimum Wage Rock and Roll. Remember that?
I do. I remember them.
Yeah, me too, man. I loved that show. But she said something to me that I always remembered. And she said, get your chops at home. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You know, do a few years at home. Then you can run to L.A. if you want.
And where was home at that time? Arizona, or did you go back
Arizona,
to Washington?
Arizona was
so
home.
So you stayed in Arizona.
Well, yeah. I started doing a show there called The Comedy Corner.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of fun. It was in the food court area, in the Student Union.
Yeah.
And they had a little area there that you could go and eat your stuff. So yeah. It was just tables and chairs, but it was nice. It was layered.
Yeah.
And the stage was about a foot off the ground. A nice little theater
daytime,
experience.
Daytime.
We'd do it at noon on Friday. I read about it. It had been going on for maybe a year and a half, and I read about it because they got an article about it in the school newspaper.
So it wasn't your show. You just started performing on it.
I joined it. I had an audition. And
do you remember who the guys were? Any of them end up anywhere?
I think a couple of them ended up being some comedy writers. Because the funny thing was, I saw some mention about it, and I'm going, oh, you know, I'm Wikipedia this thing, and it had it, Comedy Corner, Arizona.
Yeah,
and it had my name in the thing about, some of the alumni that have come out of there. And I saw that, and I just started breaking down weeping, you know, 30 years, 40 years later.
Why, because of the alumni?
No, because I saw that, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm their go-to guy for like that.
You're the guy who made it.
I'm the guy who made it. And like, you got to take a look around my cockroach-infested studio and reconsider that Wikipedia paragraph. But Mark, I didn't come here to talk about that.
We can. So you grew up in rural West Virginia.
Yeah.
And then you went to college at the University of Arizona.
Yeah, University of Arizona.
What did you do in high school though? Were you a madman?
I was a madman.
What kind of car did you drive? What kind of trouble was there to be had in rural West Virginia?
Well,
Were you in jail?
Yes, just once. But my dad, he was a gynecologist, and there were five magistrates, five judges.
Yeah.
And one day I'm driving around with my friend Jimmy Prescott, and I don't know who else. And you know, we had our quarts of Miller beer and our beer nuts.
Yeah.
And I'm up up in the hills, this area called Oglesby Park.
Mm-hmm.
So they had all these forest rangers there. And I'm like, hey, Jimmy, watch this. And I start driving around the golf course. And then I, you know, go driving around the trap, sand trap. Go, oh, that was close.
Yeah.
And then up onto the green. Like, it's in the hole.
Yeah.
And then boom, at either side of me, man.
Cops.
And I just slammed it into reverse, man. And I start taking off.
You were actually in a high speed chase in a golf cart on a course.
Not a golf cart in my car.
Oh, okay. So
tearing up this golf course that was designed by Robert Trent Jones.
So the instinct was to run. I like that because you can't do that anymore. Not with helicopters, but this is pre helicopter.
Well,
so you thought like Dukes of Hazzard, Smokey and the Bandit. You're going to get out.
Mm-hmm.
How long did that chase go on?
That's exactly what it was. That chase went on for about. Well, from that point on, I slammed it in reverse, and that chase lasted about 10 minutes. They brought in two more sheriff cars. I thought I was gone, man. I made it up to the highway.
Yeah.
And they came at me from both sides and butt me off to the side of the road. And I'm standing there in handcuffs, and I see some friends of mine drive by, and I'm like, call my mom.
Yeah.
And, boy, that's a sad place to be in when you're going, call my mom.
Were you like 16? 17?
I mean, I've been in handcuffs since then, you know, recently. And it's like, call my mom. You're going to have to use one of those ghost radios, you know.
She's not around anymore?
She's not around anymore.
Either your parents?
Well, that's what they say.
Yeah.
I never actually saw the casket open. I mean, it's a Jewish funeral, but.
Pine
I
think box, it, baby. Your dad's still around?
No, but again, that's what they say. I think they were embarrassed by what I did. So they could have faked their own
the
death.
The whole thing? The entire life of what you did? Or just
it's whole thing, man.
Do you have siblings?
No. I know. You know, I got that cleared up.
Yeah. You have brothers and sisters? You don't.
Brothers and sisters? Yeah. I have two older sisters. Check this out, man.
Yeah.
One time, my parents go on a vacation when I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
And my oldest sister was 11, 12.
Yeah.
And my grandma was staying with us.
Yeah.
So we go to play a game, any kind of game, that you need to have a piece of paper to keep score on. So I looked around, you know, hey, here's a piece of paper. I grab it. And then she flips over the paper to see it was a special piece of stationery that she got for Hanukkah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the late 60s, early 70s, that was a huge gift.
Yeah.
you know, instead of a smartphone.
Yeah.
And she freaked out, man. And it was like Anthony Quinn grabbed a knife and came after me. It was like a fight between Gauguin and...
Van Gogh.
And Van Gogh, yeah. Kirk Douglas, yeah. Van Gogh and Gauguin. And that's what it was. And I ran for the bathroom. Because between 9 and 12, I was smaller than them. Ran for the bathroom. She's attacking the bathroom door with a knife. And my grandma, my poor grandma.
Yeah.
She didn't know what to do. Yeah. Now, this is the start of my parents' trip.
Yeah.
They came back 10 days later. Well, me and my older sister, we're not talking to each other.
Yeah.
Haven't since.
Really?
Can you imagine
that? That's not true.
No, that is true, my friend.
Wow.
Yeah, can you imagine that?
It's a long time, dude. Over stationary?
I've reached out many times. There are people, I came into the family late. You know, my dad was pushing 50 when he had me.
Yeah.
So everybody was old or gone already. You know what I mean? Yeah. Everyone was old all the time. So you're constantly going to funerals.
Yeah.
To where you're just like,
another one gone.
I'm afraid to die now.
Yeah.
Man. Well, everyone. When my grandma died.
Yeah.
I had to be a pallbearer. And I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
That's too intense, man.
It is. I did that. I was a little older. It is intense.
Yeah. It's too intense. And then, you know, they're like, just do it. You're going to be bar mitzvahed soon. You'll be lavished with pen and pencil sets and some cash and a BB gun. You'll get over it.
Yeah.
But that summer, when the sun went down, it scared the hell out of me because I thought I was going to die at night. And I used to go, when everybody went to bed, I'd get out of my bed and I'd go sit downstairs and I'd look at things. And I'd go, that's the last thing you're ever going to see. That shelf.
So you were plagued with anxiety.
At that moment, I'm fine now.
Yeah, no,
I feel great.
I know that fucking feeling. It's a horrendous feeling. I have it a little more now than I used to. This sort of, going to sleep at night. Like, is this it? I mean, I'm 50. How old are you?
I just turned 53, so, April 7th.
Let's track this thing, though. So, all right, so you leave rural West Virginia, and I think we know now that your father was a doctor.
That's right. Not gynecologist, man.
Very different than a canary salesman. I'll try to pick up the glean the facts against the mythology. I will try to.
Wait, where did I slip up?
You slipped up.
How did you know he was a doctor? You tricked me.
I didn't trick
you. You're good, man.
You said it, bro.
I did?
You said it.
Uh oh.
Yep. You know when you said it?
When?
You want to know when you pulled the curtain back?
Yeah, when? I don't remember.
Yeah, you said it when you got into the car chase and, you know, your dad knew some judges.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And then the real Bob Rubin came out. I saw him.
You're good, man.
God damn it.
That's it. I'm walking out.
Yeah, I'm walking out. Revealed. Everyone knows my dad was a gynecologist.
So anyhow, the magistrate that was on duty on that Sunday, just so happened my dad delivered 5 of his kids, so I walked.
There you go. Not bad having connections.
Nope.
So you stayed out of trouble. So basically, you know...
This is tough, man.
What is tough?
Well,
talking?
No, not talking. It's just so early. You know, I think the last time I was called upon... This isn't performing. This is just hanging out talking, you know?
It is, yeah. Well, it's weird because I was, you know, knowing how your reputation precedes you, both comedically and personally... I missed most of what was the Bob Rubin experience in San Francisco. Because had you gone to L.A. already once by the time I got there?
I had started to go to L.A. actually in 86.
Right.
You know, and then I moved to L.A. the very last day of 93. So essentially.
It was right there. Right when I got there, you left.
I did. Yeah.
Right.
And essentially, I left the last day of 93, first day of 94. And then in the first 2.5 weeks in 94, my girlfriend of 6 years dumped me. My dad died. And then there was that big Northridge earthquake.
I remember that.
So in my head, I'm thinking, welcome to L.A., son. This is going to be easy. Oh, boy, this is going to be easy.
But let's talk about your class of, because at that time, so you started doing comedy a bit in Arizona, and then you go to San Francisco in what year?
I go to San Francisco in 83.
All right, so that, you know, that's really the beginning of what became the defining modern comedy period for San Francisco.
For San Francisco, right.
Right, so you got Dana Gould, you got Jake Johansson, you got Robin around,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
You got Steve Pearl around,
uh-huh.
You got Proops and Warren Thomas,
oh.
You got Durst, you got Dr. Gonzo,
yeah.
You got Pritchard, you got...
Pritchard, yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, that is the crew, right?
Yeah.
Did I miss anybody?
Probably.
Schneider was coming.
Oh, Rob Schneider, yeah.
A little later, probably.
No, actually, he was there. He was there because he was doing stand-up in high school. He lived in Pacifica.
Right. Sue Murphy, Ellen DeGeneres.
Yep.
Yep. Slayton, Kravitz.
Slayton, Kravitz, Pearl.
So that was like the golden age of fucking San Francisco. And did I mention Dana Gould? Kevin Meaney was there, right?
Kevin.
Later?
He would come out. I think he pretty much was still a Boston. No, Kevin Meaney did come out because he was a bartender at the Holy City Zoo after Robin Williams. As a matter of fact, Robin Williams and Kevin Meaney and myself were the last three bartenders at the Holy City Zoo that were comedians. So they're all joking, especially when I came around because, you know, Robin, great success. Kevin, just a little bit later, got that Uncle Buck. And then, so they're like, oh, I guess you're next.
Right.
No, I'll fuck this up somehow. Trust me.
but what, like, the style there, because, like, you know, you, I don't know that you could have existed, you know, anywhere else other than San Francisco at that time.
No, I couldn't have existed, but I did go out and do my thing in places where they're like, I mean, I used to go to places where they're like, oh, they're never going to get you. But
right.
They did, because I would just go out and ramble on. And the whole thing was, I think, probably brought from leftovers from the 70s and early 80s, where he still had more larger-than-life type of characters being presented. But I also had a lot of great humor to back it up, and I wasn't using props or anything like that.
Right.
But I did, like, in 86, I lost The Tonight Show. I had it booked. I was standing there eavesdropping when I did the audition at the Improv, and my manager at the time went up to, I think, Jimmy Brogan at
yeah.
the time, and this was after he'd
Who
seen
Who was your manager?
Bob Lacey.
Uh-huh.
And he came down, he got the audition for me, and he came in there to rep me, and so I went in there, and, you know, the thing is, it's like, make sure when you walk off stage, you did everything you could.
Yeah.
Because I knew back then, I knew my whole life, just if you don't get picked, just make sure it's because you didn't suck that night.
Right.
Because I'll tell you a quick story of when I did
Take
suck.
Take your time.
Okay. I'll tell you a quick story when I did suck, but let
Take
me...
Take your time.
Let me... Okay. I'm gonna kick back then.
So, but what happened on that audition?
Oh, the Tonight Show audition blew the roof off the Improv, and I did material, and you know, which I don't necessarily always do. I did boom, 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 even snapped my fingers and said boom during the set, which can irritate people.
Yeah, sure, but that's part of it. Persistence.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to bother anybody. And many people afterwards were handing me buttered top hats.
Oh.
There were large parades. But here's what happened. I'm eavesdropping, and my manager, he comes up to him like an hour after my set. He goes, your boy's brilliant, man. And he's still reciting material that I did.
Yeah.
Because he remembered it. I'm like, oh, this is good. And he goes, oh, and my manager opens up a calendar. And he's like, well, let's book him right now. And he goes, call me tomorrow. And then he called him Monday, and the guy said, well, yeah, I definitely want to book him on the show. And then 2 weeks go by, nothing happens. My manager called him up, said, and the guy said to him, well, yeah, you know, we want to put him on Johnny, but it's, what's with the character? And my manager's like, what do you mean, what's with the character? He said, well, what's with the hair and the cowboy boots and all that?
That's when you had that giant mullet bouffant thing.
Yeah, I was in what do you call that thing? Those movies with Danny Glover and Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
What were those movies called?
The Lethal
Weapon. Lethal Weapon Hair.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what
that's
I had.
Right. The Mel Gibson Lethal Weapon Hair.
Yeah.
No, you were a big boy.
Big guy,
with a big
man.
Beard,
260.
Big hair.
Yeah.
Big boots.
Yeah, man. And people, I guess, I don't know. I don't see what the big deal was, because that was not that far removed from some great character comedians.
Well, who are the guys that, who are your guys coming up that inspired you to do whatever it is that you do? I mean, I know what you're talking about, character comedians, and I know that they don't, you don't, yeah, at some point they stop being around.
Right, right.
Who were those guys?
Growing up?
Sure.
Growing up, I loved Professor Irwin Corey.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I loved Steve Martin.
Yeah.
I loved Robert Klein.
Mm-hmm.
I loved Bill Cosby.
Corey's still alive, you know. He's like almost 100. He's gonna
I
turn
didn't know a, that.
He's going to turn 100 this year.
Wow,
isn't
man.
Isn't that crazy?
Where does he live, in New York?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I'd love to see him.
You should see him. Have you met him?
No, I'd love to meet him.
I think that makes perfect sense to me, that you are a legacy of Irwin Corey.
Well, yeah, and you know what? Brother Theodore.
Yep.
And I was on the radio in New York with Brother Theodore.
Were you?
Yeah, and he shows up, and the first words out of his mouth, like, we're sitting across from each other just like you and I were, and the first words out of his mouth were, I look at you, and I hate you! I see you sitting there, such youthful, big, and your all that hair. I hate you! This morning I woke up and I looked out my bedroom window and I saw a rat garnished with tartar sauce. And in my head I'm thinking, all right, here we go, baby. Let's toss around. Let's do dueling non sequiturs because I was born to do that, you know. But I love Brother Theodore.
When was that?
That was in the 80s, about when he had hit his pinnacle off of...
And you were just in New York doing a gig or something?
Yeah.
So and had you knew of his shit before?
Yeah.
You knew
I knew who he was. I was a fan. I'd seen him on Letterman. He'd come up on Letterman and freak everybody out.
He was a trip, man. And then he ran that one-man show forever on 13th Street, I think it was. Over by 13th and University, maybe, somewhere around there.
Yeah, and I used to hear all the funny stories about people, the culturally modern hip people of that day. And somebody would say, I think it was a running gag, too, and the people didn't find out about till years later, so they wouldn't tell anybody that they were there. But you know how celebrities like to let people know that they're there? Almost like have a press agent go in first and hand out flyers.
They do that. They do have to, their publicists do that kind of stuff. Like,
he's
going to be there.
Well, what we're talking about.
Brother Theodore.
Brother Theodore, man.
Who showed up at the Brother Theodore show.
Yeah, and he'd find out about different people, and he'd have him stand up. Oh, I understand that he had Alexander Bernhardt stand up.
Right.
And everybody clapped, and the first words out of his mouth were, I hate you. And then he would keep going off. And funny shit. And then, you know, a lot of people... Somebody with a good sense of humor like Sandra, and then other people were like, oh, I want him... It became one of those things where... Please let him call my name out. And I want him to pick on me.
I want him to hate me.
I want him to hate me.
Yeah. So, I could see Brother Theodore being a guy that was fucking mind-blowing to you. And Klein, too. I mean, Klein was sort of a powerhouse. I mean, like, of just sort of like nonstop, dude. Full on.
Yep. And he was very funny.
Yeah, he was. He could really, you know, string it out. Like, I watched a set of yours from 89 that's up online from the Evening at the Improv. And, No. But see, the weird thing is that I haven't talked to many comics like you, because you're a rare thing. That you know, you guys like you don't happen all the time, because it takes such amount of perseverance and fearlessness to sort of, you know, get up there and start some lyrical fucking, you know, storm of whatever it is you're going to do, with knowing full well that the audience is going to be like, what the fuck? Maybe for the whole set,
right?
And you know, you have to rely on your wits and just your sort of focus to even build a momentum. Like, even in that set at the Evening at the Improv, it was like, no one knew what you were doing. That was, what, 89, 80, mm-hmm. 90? No one knew what the fuck you were doing.
Right.
And they just had to reckon with your own flow. And, I mean, that takes an amazing amount of balls. And I think that, you know, to find your own time zone up there is no small thing. And then to commit to it, it's a blessing and a curse, right?
I'll tell you what right now, man. I heard every word you just said. You got me. Put me down for $20.
Yeah.
Where's that in? Donate tab?
No.
That's correct. But the key word you mentioned, which shows you how in tune you are to everything, but especially what I'm doing, which is great. It's exciting. You mentioned lyrics or lyrically?
Perseverance, lyrical.
Well, perseverance. Yeah, I think that you have to... Well, I just want to say something about lyrically.
Yeah.
I try to draw a blank and then get some music rolling in my head.
Right.
Now, don't get me wrong. I have jokes just like everybody else. And then I have some rambles that are supposed to be funny.
Yeah.
I'm not up there for the sake of being weird. The proudest thing that I know of is in 31 years of doing stand-up, people have hated me viciously.
Why?
Or loved me. Because I think that I'm just up there. It's like
They don't know what to do with you either.
They don't know what to do, but also some of it gets very philosophical. It's just the truth because I'm just going, just be silly. And it's and I'm showing them that, hey, you don't have to be cool. I'm certainly not. You don't have to be hip. I'm certainly not. And then the rest of it's more like it offends somebody's senses when they've paid money and then you're out there and they think you're on drugs, you know.
Right.
But sometimes, and you've seen this.
Yeah.
Sometimes they act like make us laugh.
Yeah.
I don't think we were ever there to make them laugh.
I tend to agree with that. Yeah. I don't think that. Yeah, I think that I'd say most comedians would say no, that is the job. But I think that it seems that, you know, people like you or myself, and I don't do what you do. But the more important thing was to have a real experience, a real moment, to have something happen on stage that'll never happen again. You know whether or not it's you know a punchline or doesn't matter. Just to walk off stage and go, that's never going to happen again.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a beautiful thing. And you know what? That will hold you back more than anything.
If
you
want to, absolutely right.
Yeah, and if you want to move to LA and get into show business, that will hold you back more than anything.
Well, I have to assume that once you got down here, you know, given the notoriety that you had sort of built up in San Francisco, that what happens when you come down here is they want to box you. So they're like, oh, you're the wacky guy who's going to, you know, dance around in his underwear.
Right.
Like they got no way to really assess what it is that, you know, you're trying to do.
Right.
They're just trying to figure out how do we fit them into the garbage hump, the garbage heap that we're dumping into people's living rooms every week.
Right. What can we trim off this guy besides his beard and head to make him fit into the...
They think they know you. And the weird fucking thing about it, and I don't know if you had this experience, is that you get down here after building your thing, you built your fucking thing, and they're like, well, you'd be perfect in this thing with this guy because you're that guy. And then for a minute there, you're like, I guess I am that guy.
For a minute.
Yeah, and then you try to be that guy, and you're like, what the fuck?
For a minute, and then the next day you wake up, and you put your feet over to put your feet on the ground from your bed, and then you just start vomiting horribly, coughing up blood. And you know you don't have food poisoning, and then you stop and think, oh, it was that meeting I had yesterday over at NBC.
Yeah, my ass is bleeding. What happened over there? I've got some money in the bank.
I've got the money in the bank, but...
my ass is bleeding.
I don't even think I have enough... That's not enough money to go see a doctor for something horribly wrong I have now.
The death of my soul. My soul has cancer.
The death of my soul.
Yeah.
To encapsulate when I move down here, and then I move back... Well, not move back up. I'm still here. First set of shows I did when I moved back up north, I go, hey, man, I don't know. People in the audience go, Rube, what'd you live down here for? And I don't know, man. You know what? I woke up one morning and I said to myself, I'm tired of hanging out in the most beautiful city on the planet. I think I'm going to move to L.A. and start hanging out with some of the most sincere people in the world.
Uh-huh.
And then talk about, hey, you know, I got pulled over by the Hollywood police. Put down your hopes. Step away from your dream. You know? But the thing is, somebody like yourself, you wouldn't kowtow to that. Hey, Mark, you know what you need to do? You got to put on a Nehru jacket. I want you to cut that hair.
I've worn Nehru jackets, but it was my own choice. But the thing is that I didn't know how. It's like I was more than open to listen to what they thought I was.
You think that you were?
No, I wasn't because I just didn't know how. I was not.
Yeah, but they're telling you how. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
you wouldn't do it.
No,
it feels sick.
It does feel a little sick.
It feels sick. See, that's why this is genius. Because I went into my garage and I cut a bumper car in half and made a love seat. You go into your garage and you build a following for yourself.
Yeah.
I'm an idiot.
I don't know. Where's the bumper car?
Well, it's a nice car. I mean, it's in my studio in Hollywood. It's nice, you know.
That's not nothing.
But it doesn't sell tickets.
I know.
Don't you have people coming up now just to see Marc Maron?
Yeah.
But what by that I mean, and a lot of people don't understand. If I get some shows,
yeah,
and the crowds they're there, hey, that might be good, but they've got no clue what they're about to get into.
Right.
And nowadays, if you walk two people, used to be nothing. Nowadays, if you walk two people, you get fired on the second night. I can't have that. Hey, they're going to go to Yelp right now and write a bad review.
Is that happening to you?
Yes.
Well, let's go back. So you're bartending. You're the last on the bartending train at the Holy City Zoo. Now, I've talked to some people who remember the zoo in its heyday. I've talked to Pearl. I've talked to Robin. But the Holy City Zoo was like a club that sat like 12 people. You know, it was in San Francisco, and it was this like amazing comedy incubator. Now, is that so? You when you came from Arizona, is that the world you entered?
Yes, but. What happened was, I'll tell you what happened was, I went down there one night to get into an open mic night. This is what I saw. I saw people standing around out front going, hey, I backed over one of those plastic garbage cans with my car. I didn't even see it, man. I went right over with my wheel. Do you think that's funny? And then I saw guys working things out. I'm like, oh, fuck it, man. I don't want this. This is bullshit, man. This is San Francisco. Come on. The whole thing should be a party. I don't want to rehearse. I want to be Hunter Thompson. I want to be Jackie Gleason. Just give me some drinks and point me to the stage, man. And I walked away. Now, in my head, I'm thinking, you're going to want to do this. So don't move back anywhere. Don't move to Tucson. Don't move to West Virginia. Whatever. You're going to want to do this. So it took a year. A year later, I did want to do it. So I was able to get on a bus rather than worry about a plane ticket. And then I went down there and everything was different. So I started doing the Holy City Zoo. You know, because the other thing I remember was Bruce Springsteen on the cover of Newsweek and Time at the same thing. And the one thing that always stuck out to me was in one of those articles, he said, I was always a rock star. He said, I crashed on couches. I borrowed some money. Wasn't embarrassing to me, and I paid everybody back. Now, 30 years later, I'm the same way. The only embarrassing thing is, not counting you, but a lot of people in this town do the quick math. I got like, $30,000 I got to pay back.
Yeah.
But I still believe I can hit the big top mark.
Well, I think you
big
can.
Big time, I mean.
I'm on board, Bob. Well, let's talk about the rolling and tumbling. through the last 20 years, Bob.
Oh my goodness! Wow.
So like when you were at the zoo, so you would watch Robin, you'd watch Steve, and you know there was definitely that sort of amazing. What I think what was great about San Francisco is that the city was very enabling of indulgence, and they liked people to sort of push the envelope and take risks and do weird shit. It's like it really is one of the only cities that is at that time was sort of like, hey man, if he's gonna put it out there, we'll take it in. And you're like you're becoming a local fixture,
right?
The old Rube,
right? And people are going around saying, oh, by the way, the old Rube. Let me tell you something. One day, I'm playing cards in my flat with two friends of mine, and I'm just making them laugh, goofing around, making them laugh. And then we had the music playing and cranked. Mm-hmm. This was at 4 in the afternoon. One of those two flats. We were on the upper flat.
Yeah.
So this woman downstairs, she's freaking out. I was like, it's 2 in the afternoon. She goes, I got a baby. I was like, but we're all babies, you know, it's 2 in the afternoon. And so then I said to her, so that night, I got my friends, and we got robes and candles, and we started doing fake Gregorian chants.
Yeah.
And I knocked on her door. Can we borrow your baby for like 10 minutes?
Yeah.
And then she called the guy that owned the building, and somehow we got evicted for that.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how that
was. Scaring a woman with a baby?
No,
with a fake satanic idea?
How can you say that? We didn't threaten her. It was just a suggestion. It could have been Halloween.
So you're out of that flat.
Hey, if there was somebody on the radio telling us how to get out of a DUI and scaring a baby for ritual sacrifice, we would have hired him. We probably would have got away with it. So anyhow, I'm joking around. Like, and we were stoned and like, what do you want to get to eat? And I just kept rambling. Oh, you got to get that big old plate of hash browns.
Yeah.
I just kept rambling that.
Yeah.
So then we go to work that night, and one friend was the doorman, and he said, he goes, you got to do that routine, man.
The hash browns routine.
Huh?
The hash browns routine.
Yeah, and I'm going, what routine? He goes, the hash browns routine. I said, that's not a routine. We were just joking around. And I go up, and he comes walking towards the stage like,
yeah, do it.
Got to do it. Yeah. So I just went into it, and the place fell out.
Just the repetition of hash browns.
The repetition and then the extensions and describing the differences, different adjectives and all that.
Yeah.
And it was also a part of the style back then, if you knew how to do it.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist really too much now.
The
but,
building on the absurdity.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it doesn't exist too much now.
No, not too much now.
And so, I know one guy that does it. The guy who opens for me does it. But it's a tough one, you know, and I miss it. I miss seeing that shit.
Well, I have continued to push forward.
Yeah.
With it. And I found out while continuing, I mean, and by that I mean new material.
Mm-hmm.
And by continuing to push forward with it, the entire earth has continued to push me out. So I'm, if I could just get enough money together, I'm going to probably get one of those astronaut suits or something, man.
Where they'll appreciate you.
Oh, I'm going on a journey.
You're needed in space, Bob.
That's what I keep telling myself when the phone isn't ringing. Well, I tell you, I was performing at the Holy City Zoo, and then, so I built up a couple of those heavily modulated, definite, way out there.
Yeah.
For like 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Then I would go into, I had some sort of thing to break that part up. Then I'd go into me. So I got to the point where I really couldn't follow me. It was like the first 6 months of stand-up versus the next year and a half.
Right.
So I became this the whole time. That was fun. And then what was funny was I was sitting with Goldthwait one day in San Francisco, and I said to him, I go, you know, I always thought it'd be funny to go out.
Oh, he was there too. I forgot about that. He came out in what, like the 80s, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I said to him, I go, you know, I always thought it'd be funny to go out, a couple things. Go, you know, you go out and you have to say something like, hey, yeah. Welcome. How's everyone doing? So I said, I just thought it'd be funny to go out and go, lighten up, everybody. The old Rube's here.
Yeah.
Like, oh, finally. You know, the guy that knows everybody's waiting to see him. But reality is you try to avoid eye contact if you catch him two blocks down the street.
Yeah.
You know, everybody, like, I could lead a room of Jethro's if I was in a room of Jethro's. And then the other thing was I would start off fast and maniacal with these deep, long rambles. And I wanted to give the feel of like I was in the middle of a 45-minute set.
Right.
You came in on the middle.
Right.
I just thought that was hysterical.
Yeah.
Now, I was toying with some other ideas, but here's what's funny as far as trying to find some rearranging the chords, right?
You know, yeah.
Infinite amount of chords, infinite amount of notes, but look at all the great different music we have, right?
Yeah.
Well, I read those notes that Mark Twain sent to his daughter, I think.
Yeah.
And he's talking about the same thing.
Yeah.
It's crazy, man. It's just crazy.
The same thing as what you're talking about?
Yeah, like yeah. Starting off like a Hawthorne, you know, switching the rhythms that people are used to in when they go to see a show.
Right.
And then he said whenever people were talking.
Because he was a performer.
He was a performer.
Yeah.
A brilliant performer.
Yeah.
And he did a simple thing, which we forget to do to this day. I don't think I've ever done it.
What?
He would continue to talk, but he would lower his voice each time until eventually people just.
Had to bend in.
Yeah, what's that guy talking about?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they'd stop talking with each other. That's really smart.
Yeah.
You know.
So you were very aware of your style and and you were very you knew what you wanted to do. And you know, you had this sort of like you were an orchestra leader, the orchestra of Bob.
Right, exactly. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Where did the I've watched you've addressed your demons.
Yeah.
At length in many different formats.
Oh yeah,
and I don't know what if you've negotiated with them to the point where life is tolerable.
Well, I fell in love. I have a beautiful woman who loves me.
Yeah,
and it's true love.
Yeah,
and I'll tell you, some people have to wait to page 246. I found true love on page 18, man.
Yeah,
incredible. I was really down and out. This is when I still had my apartment. I recently lost my apartment of 18 years.
Here in L.A.?
I'm still here in L.A., but I live in the El Nida or all you need is $16 a night and the will to live.
Are you living there?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I had this killer pad, man. Sanctuary. Mm-hmm. You got to have sanctuary, mm-hmm. you know. And I lost it. No big deal. Things will turn around. What was my point? Oh.
Demons.
Yeah, I'm laying on my couch in the fetal position, probably for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I'm not kidding you. One day, I'm laying there in the fetal position, and my mom's hands and face, like out of one of those sand demon movies, appeared and kissed me on my forehead. And I bolted upright and went, whoa! Doing that, trying to catch my breath. It was very real.
Yeah.
And I was like, took it as a sign from my mom, get up, is your aunt done? Get yeah. up, son. And then from that point on, I started doing Dana Gibson's room out in Hillhurst. And
right. What happened to that woman? Is she around still?
Yeah, she's out in Santa Monica. I don't know what your day's looking like, but it's beautiful. If you want to do a little beach volleyball with me later, you know. But
I haven't heard that name in a while.
Yeah, she's doing fine. She's out in Santa Monica.
So I guess the ultimate question is that over the course of your career, and, you know, like I've known it, you know, so it's out there that, you know, you either had good Bob or bad Bob.
Oh, sure.
On any given night.
You talk about on stage.
Well, yeah. And, you know, how much fuel had Bob ingested to get back to old Bob?
Sure.
And what has that struggle been like, man?
Well,
the booze.
I knew what you were talking about. Well, a lot of it, I'm not... I'll tell you everything you want.
Okay.
They warned me you were going to get hard with me.
No, I ain't going to get
they
hard.
They warned me.
I just want you to be comfortable.
You didn't get hard. I'm just joking. This is the most comfortable I've ever been. Like I said, no one's asked me a question in 6 years.
Yeah.
And I've answered a lot of them. I'm having a great time.
I talked to somebody recently who saw you do an hour and said it was fucking genius. So, I mean, obviously it's still percolating and obviously you're still who you are. But, I mean,
here's the demons. The demons were, I started to drink a lot, you know, because I wanted to be like Jackie Gleason. And then what happened was I started probably to drink too much. And you can believe this or not believe this. Didn't drink before I went up on stage. But the thing was, because of my mania, when I got off that stage, good or bad.
You want, yeah.
I had to stay up.
Keep it going.
I wanted to keep it going. I was like, come on. Come on. Where is everybody?
Yeah.
Come on, man. And then the next thing you know, I'd be drinking till, you know, 11 o'clock the next morning. I'd sleep all day, barely get up to go do my show. And then the show suffered because I was exhausted, and you could see this.
Right.
All the way down, man, and just the sweat pouring out, the booze sweat, and people, and then I'd get angry, man. I'd get angry. I'd say, I will send you out of here in record time, you know. And
so you're walking rooms?
I was walking rooms, and it wasn't very good, but I did a lot of fashion shows at the time, too. I was a big, good-looking guy back then. Never walked a fashion show. You know, when I felt that the respect needed, I was there for it. And
But do you think you fucked up?
Yeah, probably. I think I fucked up.
Yeah.
I think I fucked up, but not when you consider. But okay, I fucked up. But here's the thing. The guy at the Tonight Show is like, yo, well, what's with the character? What's with the beer and air? And my manager at the time said, no. That's who he is. That's who he is. And by the way, a lot of those times where people saw me drink too much would have been up in the Bay Area where I had a wild, wild following. And I could go on the Bennett Show and then say, hey, I'll be playing at a sewer on 9th and Irving.
Yeah.
And there'd be 300 people show up in that sewer.
Yeah.
And then the other thing was it got too crazy and I knew it wasn't going to last. And I didn't have... You know, I'm a humble guy. I'm a nice guy. I like to see everybody having fun. It was a lot of fun,
yeah.
You know. Now, here's what's interesting. In 85, I did Comedy Day in the Park. 40,000 people there. I've got this video, man. It's kind of sad because Warren's standing right next to me. And
he's passed.
And he's passed, yeah. He had a lot of,
yeah.
a lot of demons, yeah. you know. But Doug Keogh's introducing me. 40,000 people in Golden Gate Park for the free comedy show on a Sunday afternoon. And they go, this next gentleman, they knew it. And the whole crowd is chanting, Rube, Rube. You know, it's like they're not booing. They're saying, get off the stage.
Get Rube on there.
They're going, Rube. And you can see Warren's there. They love you, man. Rube. So I go out and dressed a homemade thing, dressed like a pink poodle. I had on white overalls. Now, this is the weird thing. I took cotton balls and sprayed them with pink can of spray, paint. And glued them. Mm-hmm. So now I got spray paint and glue. Now I had built this homemade frame out of wood and two heavy poles that you get like at Home Depot. Yeah. And then from it, I hung out of, you know, that type of piping that you find under a sink so you can, it bends.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes a circle. Yeah. I made a circle, hung it to this thing. Then I took bath towels, chicken wired it, soaked them in lighter fluid. And in the park, I practiced jumping through it, not lighting it up, so I had one chance to get it right. And it's bringing tears to my eyes.
Yeah.
I had one chance to get it right, and I go flying through this hoop, big stage, and I couldn't see anything because there was way too much lighter fluid.
Yeah.
And I'm a human torch ready to go up. And I go through there. The bottom part, it burned off as I jumped through, and the thing lands on me. And now my costume's on fire. So two guys with... what do you call it? Fire extinguishers come in, and it's that white stuff.
Yeah.
So that just kept spraying, and I'm reaching my hand, because what that white stuff does is suck oxygen out of the immediate area. So I stood up, and I couldn't breathe, you know, and I was standing around, and I had to go out and finish the set, which I did.
40,000 people saw that happen.
40,000 people saw it happen. The next year, but I want to make a point to that, but let me tell you, next year, I'm sitting backstage, I'm just going to go out and do a set. But I'm kind of bummed. I wanted to do something big.
Yeah.
Because the whole point of that was, why would you do something like that, you know, which was later expanded upon by Jackass, right?
Yeah.
Well, anyhow, I'm sitting backstage, and I don't have anything to do. My friend's little girl's about 3 years old. She's hanging around. And I said to my friend, can I borrow your daughter? She goes, yeah, sure. And I had a funny idea, and I took a tablecloth off one of those banquet tables, tied it around my neck like a sling, and I put her on it, and her cute little, she was dressed in her Sunday best with patent leather shoes, little doily socks, cute as a button, and I sit her there. So basically, she's blocking my chest.
Yeah.
So I walk out on stage after they introduce me, and I'm doing throwaway jokes on purpose, like I'm really nervous. And then I go, folks, I hate to bring this up on such a beautiful day like today, but... all week long, I received several death threats warning me not to come out here today. But let me tell you something. I love you people, and nothing was going to keep me from coming out here. Of course, you know, I'm not taking any chances. There was like 3 seconds of nothing. Now, before I walked out, people said, you can't do that. They're going to hate that. 3 seconds of nothing, and then 7-minute laugh, the longest laugh I ever had, because it spread over 40,000 it was fun. My point was, when you do stand up for 2 years and there are already 40,000 people chanting Rube, that's like walking on the moon in your first 2 years.
Yeah.
Knowing it's not real. I never had an ego. I never had an asshole. A lot of people didn't understand me. Some people were afraid of me because they'd go into a bar and they'd say, I saw you, man. There were like 18 empty shot glasses in front of you. And oh, no, I was just building a mystique. Mm. I actually went around the bar and collected them and sat behind them.
You did? Know? No.
No, I drank them.
You had a good time.
Yeah, and see, I wanted it to continue to be a good time. And you know what? Even like in the green room, I always remember, it's just like, hey, everybody, and I would get stuff for everybody. You need some chicken wings. You need some, you need something to drink. Blah, blah, blah. And then if I heard my name introduced, I'll be right back. I just got to go do this thing.
So the thing was, like, at that time in San Francisco with Bobcat and some of the other people, like, you know, an act that had balls like that and that was unique, they just loved it. It was that time.
It was that time.
And so you got caught up in this shit.
Right. But interesting that you said that, because we were aware. The reason we loved it is that we were aware it was that time. Like one time, I'm on stage at the Walnut Creek Punchline, and And I knew one thing, take advantage of this. Look, at the time, if I got a Letterman spot, I wouldn't have been pulling any of this stuff. And by the way, even in those days, you know those auditions you do where you actually get to do stand-up in a club?
Yeah.
Instead of going into a studio and trying to read. Well, I always figured, I always knew back then, I go, just because you're good doesn't mean they're going to pick you. Mm-hmm. But make sure you're great that night, man. Walk off saying, well, I did my part. 9 out of 10 of those, I did that.
Yeah.
Once I didn't, and that was the Saturday Night Live one, man. I was like, I was going to get in there as a writer, and they say, oh, they're having a rare middle-of-the-season audition. You got to go to New York and do it. And Jay Moore, the guy that used to do the news, what's that guy? Funny guy,
Norm.
Man. Norm got picked. A lot of great guys got picked that night.
And you did. You were where did it happen?
Was it Comic Strip?
Yeah, and yeah. What happened?
Well, the show wasn't going to start till everybody got there, which is Lauren and
Marcy.
Yeah, and the head writer at the time. They didn't
Downey.
Get there. Jim Downey, yeah. Well, they didn't get there till late, so it's like, oh, already you got a dead crowd. Then you had to pick out of a hat, and I picked 9 out of 9th. So there was just basically them and 3 people left when I had to go up.
Wow.
And I could see, like, guys with wooden legs rounding third trying to think they're going to be safe, and just the umpire going, yeah! I mean, the whole thing was disastrous. It was so hard to get. I cried when it was over. I cried.
What'd you do up there?
I bombed, man. That was the 10. 9 out of 10. And twice, you know, for Montreal Comedy Festival, took the house down. And what's with that character and the boots and the...
Yeah.
Jesus God, man! Can't a guy wear boots?
So you that didn't happen. Then
you wear shirts when you perform.
I do. Usually.
Nobody's complaining about that.
Well, you've mentioned Mania.
Nice shirts too.
What about that? Are you bipolar guy?
Oh yeah. And a lot of us are becoming extinct in the city because the ice caps are melting. You know.
Sure.
And twice I did a show, and doctors came out to me, and they said, this is 2 different times, not, you know, like back-to-back. This is probably 5-6 years in between.
Yeah.
A doctor would come up and say, you need to see me. You need to come in my office and see me. I go, yeah, why's that? Oh, it's obvious you're suffering from bipolar mania. And my response always was, would you like me to sign something for you? You know, and then the second one, she did want me to sign something.
Yeah.
You know, as in stay away camp. You know?
You went in?
3 days, nature films for 3 straight days. I came out feeling pretty calm. You don't need the pills, man. Just watch nature films. And
you checked in for a few days.
I was tricked into checking in because of the same thing, man. You know?
Yeah.
But that didn't help me. You know, like I said, you watch nature films for 3 days, and naturally you come out of there thinking, hey, you know what? There's not one nature film that's scored by big band music.
Yeah.
That's all you get.
Yeah.
But you still feel like, oh, hi.
Yeah.
I'm going to do a show. This show's going to last 7, maybe 8 days. it's a lot of fun.
So you,
I still have my general enthusiasm for the whole thing.
You never got on medicine.
I did, yeah.
How'd that work?
It never worked.
Yeah.
It never worked. And then what I would do was when I hurt my career because I was making enough money, like in one show,
yeah,
where I could go hide for another 3 or 4 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And see, I didn't want to. I'd heard about the crazy things people do on Mania. I was afraid I might do that. Although, you know what? To be honest with you, I was never actually afraid. I was just too thin-skinned at the time. And then when you go down, you're so depressed. And basically, I can remember. Should we talk about this stuff, or is it too boring?
No, it's great.
Okay. So I remember sitting on my couch like this. Here, let me get in closer to the mic. I sitting on my couch going, with my arms, and this shoulder weighed 850 pounds.
This is when you were down.
Yeah. This shoulder weighed another 850. Could barely get finger movement. I look over, I go, hey. I tried to point, too. I couldn't even get my finger up. I go, whoa. There are my books. Oh, my favorite books. No, I can't read those. Hey, look. Look at all the music I have. Well, I can't listen to that. Well, I've got a TV and I've got a DVD player and I could watch a movie. No, I couldn't. Yeah. You know, that's the what worst. It was like. Yeah, that's what worst. It was like. So what happened?
How long would those last?
Those could last up to 2 years, you know.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Between
yeah.
mania.
Yeah, 2 years.
Fuck.
And what happened was, I'd say it took away 10, 11 years of my life, and I was left alone. And then, but the thing, I did a good job of hiding it.
Yeah.
Because the larger-than-life type of character, the old Rube thing,
yeah.
that was not intended for hiding something like that. You yeah. know, when I did that back in, started to do that, it was just fun and natural.
Yeah.
And I told you the reasons.
Yeah.
I was making some friends laugh, number one. Hanging around with Bobcat going, you know what would be funny? A guy who thinks...
It's also your style. You knew what your style was.
Right. Yeah. It always worked as my style, and I still do it to some degree, but with new material. You yeah. know?
So how did you hide the sadness?
Well, I just hold up. I hold up, and then the next thing I knew, I was homeless, you know? I lost my apartment, and, you know, it's... Just and then you couldn't enjoy anything. So how yeah. the hell are you going to generate new material?
Yeah.
See, that really worried me. And then your family goes, oh, he's turned his back on us.
Yeah.
And you know, if I was in a full body cast in the hospital,
yeah.
Somebody from my family might come in and go, "Is something wrong? What happened? Were you in an accident? You sick?"
That's such a rough thing about growing up with doctors, man.
Right, right. Yeah. My dad, man, he'd never go to a doctor.
Yeah.
One time I was back there when I was still in Arizona, and I was in a hotel room. I walked into the hotel room, and his mom were in, and him and my mom were in this hotel room. And my dad's like beating on his leg, and my mom's looking at me like, and then he realizes that we're both looking at him, and he immediately went into the Charleston.
Oh.
Died the fact that, and then
what was wrong with his leg?
A week later, he collapses in the shower. Fortunately, I was home. I dragged him out. We called the ambulance. Immediate surgery. They took out a tumor pressing on his spine. It was fortunately benign. Hey, that's going to be my new musical. What the fuck happened to my family?
Yeah,
but had it gone on for much longer, maybe if he didn't even get to the hospital when he did that day, he'd have been paralyzed from the waist down.
Holy shit. So just don't go to the doctor. So where are you at now with it? You know, Bobby, I mean, you're living in this SRO. Is that where you're living?
Oh, I'd love to get back to SRO. They used to do that at the Punchline, man. I did 3 shows a night, SRO. Standing room only. Show talk. SRO.
Single room occupancy.
Oh, that's right.
Well, what are you doing about the illness?
Well, I'm under wonderful treatment. You know, I should have known this because I went into, this is years ago, man. I walked into the mental health care clinic and, you know, it's the only building in this town where I ever walked into and they said, "You're perfect." And and you know what?
Yeah.
They're helping me a lot.
They are now?
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
I feel real good.
Good.
And prior to going there, I was fighting it on my own. And I had my good moments.
Some bad years, though.
Well, 10 years of my life was taken away. Though I'm trying to build an audience again. I started a web thing. I don't want to get too technical about it.
Go ahead, man.
Well, I've got a show called Banana Land.
Okay.
And it's at bananaland.tv.
Okay.
And you could download everything there to play on your different iPods and all that. But it's not on iTunes. It's just silly. Nobody should do what you do because nobody does it better than you. And I'm certainly not going to do it.
Yeah.
And
well, I appreciate that.
No, it's true, man. Seriously, it's true. It's so easy. I could talk for hours and hours here.
Are you doing stand-up too?
Oh, yeah. No, I've never stopped doing stand-up. And I always worked on new material and all that. You know, I'm the only guy that you could think of, you know, as far as your generation, my generation.
Yeah.
Generation just a half inch before us, a generation a half inch after us, that's never done a late night chat show.
Yeah.
And like Billy Connolly, you know, I was in a movie with him and I ran into him after a performance and I'm like, "Hey, Billy." Oh, I was with a friend of mine and I had a TV set, you know, like a 4.5 minute set on a DVD. And I was with my friend Elena, because I'm like, I'm going to schmooze. This would have been my, it was a 20 year mark.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, I'm not here to not work and get things done. Once every 20 years, I will schmooze.
Yeah.
And I went up to Billy and wasn't going to do it. She's like, oh, Bob has, so I go, hey, Billy, I hate to do this. Dustin Hoffman was standing right next to him, you know, and it's reception. And then, hey, do you think you could get this to Craig Ferguson and help me get on the show, man? He's like, showroom, no problem. And then a half hour later when I'm walking out, he stops me and he goes, Rube, I'm going to put in a good word for you, big time. But I don't think that he did, or they hate me. I'm going to try to get I'd like to do Conan or Ferguson. I'm just not sure the path to take. I'm not represented by anybody right now. I'm working on a book, which is fun. And so I'm going to try to just build my online.
Good, man.
Yeah, and I got some folk, a lot of fans from the Boondock Saints movie I was in. They're already up on the internet stuff.
What was that movie?
Well, in 1999, they put this movie out called The Boondock Saints. It's about these two vigilante brothers that clean up crime in Boston. Great movie, but when it was about to be released, it was when the Columbine shooting happened. So it got blackballed. Well, the producer ends up at some point later getting it into Blockbuster, and it just becomes a word-of-mouth wild hit. To this day, it's in the top 20 of most rented DVDs. You know, along there were Star Wars and all that.
And you got a lead in that?
No, I did the sequel.
Okay.
And I had a funny character, but a gangster.
Yeah.
And I'm the only gangster that lived in two out of the two movies.
Oh, good.
So, but I had a gangster and a crazed meth. I did a movie with Sonny Barger.
Yeah, Sonny Barger.
And the Hells Angels.
Yeah.
They're getting into the movie business now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, man. Yeah, if people listen, if they would just go to Santa.
Did he remember you from the old days? From San Francisco? Oakland?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, hey, why don't you go get me a canary? I'm like, hey, those days were long ago, Mr. Barger. Oh, okay, sorry, Rube. Shut up and go get me a canary.
I think that's the best way to end this I can think of.
I had a lot of fun.
Thanks, buddy. All right, folks, that's our show, The Rube. I'm glad he's holding up and he's doing okay and he's back on top of stuff. It was great to talk to Bob Rubin. Go look him up. See what he used to be. See what he is now. Go to WTFpod.com. Get some merch for your holidays. I'm all jacked up, man. I'm going to go get a haircut. And I'm glad Monkey's doing better. I'm just gonna keep hydrating him with wet food, and I'm gonna add water to the wet food. I'm gonna make sure his water is clean, and I'm gonna give him love, and I'm gonna try to hide my anxiety. Okay? That's what I'm gonna do. Thank you all for coming to the Trippany House shows. I'm gonna do more. I'll let you know. I don't think they're up on the website yet. I'll tell you that Monday.
was completely unplanned. It felt a little scattered. I was in the moment, though. I lost my confidence for like just like a couple of chords. Oh, Boomer lives! Hey, folks. This episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.